And here we are.
Here we are.
Yep.
Puck Lawrence, Lawrence Blair, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
I'm going to let Rushi kind of lead this one because Rushi has been interested.
Big fan.
Big fan.
For a little while. Yeah.
She's wanted to talk to you for a long time. And it took me a while to get my shit together.
Get your interest up.
Not my interest. I was very interested. You're a fascinating character. But last time, sorry, we had technical difficulties. Sorry, we had to bail last minute.
But this is even better because we get to actually be here with you.
Yeah.
And we're getting to record this and film it. So
definitely.
I think we're good. So I kind of want to start off by talking to you about your relationship to this island and also to Aldous Huxley's island. I remember you kind of told me that story before. I don't know if you know, but that's kind of the main kickoff for this, the reason of this podcast. I read the book years ago, came to this island and was like, something seems a bit similar. I find a lot of similar. Yes. So we've kind of discussed that previously. Mm. So maybe you want to share with us like...
The irony is I don't think Aldous Huxley ever actually came to Bali, but his island in his book, Island, is extraordinarily like it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I did find myself at one point actually commissioned to write the film screenplay by his widow, by Aldous Huxley's widow. And we have a closer connection with Aldous Huxley because my mother, my parents emigrated to Mexico from England when I was mm-hmm. 14 with my brother, who was 11 at the time, which was a fantastic event in our lives. And everything picked up and color came into the world and everything. And at one point, this was the 50s, maybe 55, 56, my mother read Aldous Huxley's Heaven and Hell.
Mm-hmm.
So she decided to take some mescaline.
Did she?
And I was her 14-year-old scribe, commanded to come into her bedroom and write down her whatever was going on. And it was quite alarming at one level because she was throwing up, but it was absolutely amazing from the standpoint of what she was saying. So that is our close connection with Aldous Huxley, two of them. And of course, I've always loved his idea in Ireland of that if you teach all the birds to remind you to stay awake, to be mm-hmm. awake, to be conscious.
Attention.
So they all tell you attention, exactly, so that you are aware. It's rather a brilliant idea.
Little reminders to stay present.
That's
and
right.
There's so many similarities that we can't kind of are alluded to, I would say, like they have the mutual adoption clubs. And it's very much similar to how families kind of operate in Bali. They're very much sort of throw your kids in, everyone's doors are open. And there was also aspects of education and like how religion and things are brought in at such a young age.
And even trance from such a young age.
Yeah.
I mean, in the West, it horrifies people that you would teach children or even young adults trance, because that is all the chaos that the Western mind wants to keep at bay.
So when did you actually come to Bali?
I made it in about 1973. I came to Indonesia for the first time in 1965, the year of living dangerously.
Wow.
And I was as a delegate to a conference, a spiritual conference in Jakarta. I never made it down to Bali for a week. And that was mm-hmm. because there was a lot of killing going on all over the place.
And then, in fact, I
did several expeditions and films. The very first film, Sailing with the Bugis for thousands of miles across the Banda Sea, was before we even got to Bali, because we considered any island with an international hotel and an international airport as beneath our dignity.
Oh. This was you and your brother traveling around, and then that whole story is chronicled in Ring of Fire.
That's right.
Right? And then now... That's been remastered, I guess.
It's available on Disney Channel and various other things. You can get it on YouTube. So it shows you what was going on then in the 1970s. It was really based on 10 years of psychoanthropological data gathering. I am an mm-hmm. anthropologist. I specialize in a field called psychoanthropology. And the idea was to track, find, live with tribal peoples who hadn't yet been contacted even by their own governments or by missionary groups, and to live with them long enough to capture as much as one could of their lives and their beliefs and their mm-hmm. but on camera before they forever disappeared, which many of them of course since have. So in a sense now this film is much more valuable than it was in the past.
And on those travels, what was sort of like the, I mean, there's a lot of magic in Indonesia and you feel it for sure. So maybe what were some of your most magical moments on on your travels?
Well, we did spend a 9-month period traveling all over Java and Bali and Sumatra and southern Sulawesi, trying to find wise men, magicians, the thing which Indonesia is known for, which India was known for perhaps in the past, still is, but I mean, that's where we all got the first idea from.
Yeah.
And it seems as if as India became more sort of literate and so-called civilized, Indonesia was the last great pocket of this transcendental technology of the soul. And we came across a lot of charlatans, probably more than you'd find anywhere else. And we also came across a few of the real McCoy, but very few of them wanted to appear on camera. And the most remarkable of them was this man who we referred to as Dynamo Jack, who had practiced a form of Qigong, a Chinese form of controlling the qi energy in your body, which all sounds like so much woo, until he takes you by the hand and says, "Are you ready?" And you say, "Yes," and then he delivers an incredible shock. And not only that, he could, by controlled use of qi, as he put it, as he described it, he could ignite newspapers, he could pull things into his hand from a distance of some 3 or 4 feet. And above all, he used it as a healer, because this is a technique, this type of qigong, which can be used as a martial art or to heal with.
Right.
And you use the acupuncture points, which is what he did. Sometimes he didn't even touch them. He held his hand above them. And on many occasions, we actually followed him around Java on his healing expeditions. People would pour in to see him from all over the place. He was required not to receive any money at all. You could receive, he could receive gifts. That's why, because he was also a healer to the president of Indonesia, his present from the president was to send his kids to school in California.
Wow.
And but as his sort of assistant observer, he wouldn't let us film him. And he said, why? Because he says, as soon as a Westerner sees what I'm doing, they'll think I'm a trickster. And if I tell them that they too could learn this if they spent the time and energy that is required to do it, they'd think I was a liar as well as a trickster. So why bother? I've got my hands full. There are people pouring in. And my life is good. Why should I? And it was only a sort of a mistake, I suppose, the fact that, it wasn't very clear in Indonesian, which it still isn't, what is to document something in a documentary. He thought it was just to document this, not that it was for a documentary. So when it came out in Ring of Fire in 1988, it was all over the world, like 62 countries this was seen. He was bombarded by people. He had to withdraw and hide. And he was furious with me and my brother. He wouldn't see us for a long time. And then after my brother died, which he did here in Indonesia in 95, after that, Dynamo Jack contacted me. Dynamo Jack, we called him, because he didn't want his real name given out or his address given out for obvious reasons. And then he contacted me. He said, look, I need you to film me after all. All is forgiven. Come and film me, because I realize now that this power, which was something much more common throughout the planet, is diminishing proportionate to the rise of technology, to the rise of left brain development of the planet. And there aren't that many of us left. And I just want to leave you a bit of a record to so that you know what you're still capable of before it just becomes like other things, a thing we could once do and have forgotten.
I actually was told that years ago in India as well, like that a lot of the powers that like Shiva and all the gods had, we did have the ability to achieve a lot of that kind of omnipotence.
Yes.
And these things are like forgotten knowledges. Yes. So,
and yet we still know them in our dreams and in our mythology and in our beliefs. Perhaps our optimism springs from a knowledge of what we have been in the past.
And there's also a lot more, I feel, distraction in the world now that maybe pulls people away from being able to pursue these kind of things.
I love that. It reminds me of the episode we did about Alan Watts, and he called it the original intelligence. And he's talking, I don't know if you've heard this before, Pac Lawrence, it was the Houseboat Summit 1967. Alan Watts, Timothy Leary, Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, and they were all talking about this tribal future that they saw coming, you know, the kind of degradation of Western society and these little tribes breaking off.
Yes.
And that's a big reason we wanted to talk to you, because you were at the forefront of a lot of this. You knew a lot of these people. You were around. That was kind of your day. So what you're describing here, can we connect that to your larger purpose, it seems, in life? I don't want to tell you what your purpose is, but from the outside looking in.
I couldn't anyway, because there's what it is.
Well, what it seems like to me is that you're an anthropologist, like you said. You're a PhD, you're a highly educated man. You know, you can engage that left brain when necessary, but you're also trying to connect that to the spiritual, the mystical.
The resonance of the universe.
Yeah, which I think is so interesting and such, that seems to be what's coming now, is that you have a lot of people that are disillusioned by religion. Mm. And then you have a lot of people in the Western world, especially California, that are attaching to science and technology, and they've abandoned a lot of the spiritual religious pursuits. And what I find so cool about you is that you're kind of bridging that gap. So maybe if we could talk a little bit more about that. And, you know, obviously you're in your retirement age and you're getting towards
way past it.
I was trying to be generous there, but you're still kicking, you're still doing stuff, you're still doing lectures, you're still doing films. What is it that you want to leave people with?
With a sense of awe. Because a lot of people are rather depressed. And if we just look at the media, it's pretty damn depressing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But you know, one thing about the so-called hippie movement in the 60s, precisely when that was going on, that houseboat, I stayed on that houseboat.
Did you?
Alan Watts wasn't there, unfortunately. He shared it with somebody called Varda, who was a sculptor. And it was an amazing houseboat full of this extraordinary glass work that Varda had put together. Uh-huh. And of course, I was influenced by him. He was a wonderful talker. I never met him. I knew Timothy Leary really quite well. I got quite a few stories about him. But Alan Watts was like the first Western articulator, I think, of Asian
Eastern
deep
philosophy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he had a great sense of humor. He had it. He'd done his homework. He was somebody who walked his talk. And it's astonishing that he isn't more recognized today, because he is a little lighthouse in this dark world of reversion back to materialism, which is so attractive in the light of AI.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the thing about that so moved me about that time was that it was recognized that tribal peoples were the last custodians of these abilities to sense what we have forgotten. The rhythms of nature, the movement of life, the interconnected, the real issues, not what you own, but what does it all mean? Where do you put your energy? We're only here for 100 years or so. And where are you going to put your energy? What is what really turns you on? So several of us, inspired by the sort of discussions that you're talking about that took place on that particular boat at that particular time, we're inspired to go out and try and find the last custodians of this ancient knowledge, because we in the scientific West have only been sort of thinking in this absurdly over-exaggerated left-brained way for 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. But the people, let's take the cannibals of New Guinea. Who I lived with at one point. Okay, they've got slightly odd habits, but they have been living successfully for 50,000 years. And when we say they've got really nasty, warlike habits, actually nothing like as bad as us Western lot have, who are prepared to bomb people from the air, men, women, and children. These guys, they fight, they ritually eat a bit of each other, only, incidentally, those from neighboring tribes and clans who have already killed and eaten a bit of their people. But you don't need an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. It is naked hand-to-hand combat. So it is fairly discreet. There's not too much of it, and it maintains a banner.
And it's completely in line with what goes on in nature as well.
Definitely.
You know, it's that's the way wars are fought in nature, are between
active territorialism.
Yeah. Yeah, we seem to have this ability to kind of circumvent a lot of the laws of physics and nature as humans. And that's what Rushi and I kind of focus a lot on, is that first, why do we do that? And how do we prevent ourselves from doing it? Because there's always this temptation to engage that left brain.
Relinquish control.
Yeah, which is difficult to do.
Of course it is. And especially we in the West have been trained with our left brains to keep control and gain control, to be in control. Whereas the thing I love about the East and about living here in Bali particularly is they're trained from an early age to relinquish all control mm-hmm. and to surrender to what is, which then makes it possible for you to be a captain in a wild sea. You know, if you've never really allowed yourself to get your feet wet, how do you know what's sloshing around?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree. It's a great metaphor too, because that's what this life is. You know, you're just kind of put out to sea and you got to sink or swim, but you're not going to be able to control it. You can't control the weather. But as humans, we think we can even do that.
That's right.
And we are in some parts of the world.
We are.
Cloud seeding and all that kind of stuff. Cool. One of my favorite stories from Ring of Fire is your trip to Sumba. And I think it kind of ties in with intelligence in nature and being able to like read the signs. And I kind of want to, I've been to Sumba now and I can say it's really not changed that dramatically compared to what I saw in your film. So, but there's the story. I know you guys were stuck there with those shamans for like quite a number of days.
Months.
Can you tell us the story?
Well, we wanted to film this rare ritual that takes place every year, which is mounted warriors on horseback. It's an island. It's a cowboy island of the South Seas, Sumba. And it's also a megalithic island. They still build these or hew these amazing great slabs of stone that they put over the graves of their kings and warriors. And until recently, they used to bury beneath those stones their slaves and horses as well, the kind of downside of magic mysticism of the tribal peoples. But there it goes. But they still have this extraordinary ritual battle, which is a veiled form of human sacrifice, where you get as many as 150 people to a side on horses, charging each other and flinging spears at each other. And the only way that this can come to an end, this ritual war sport, is if somebody is killed or if blood is drawn. Well, now the Indonesian government came along and said, you can't do this sort of thing. It's really badly behaved. And we're going to make you blunt these spears, which, of course, they took to like ducks to water, because it meant, actually, you have to go for a kill. It's much harder to draw blood with a blunted spear. Right. So they definitely began killing more people at these Pasola festivals, as they're called, than they ever had before. Now, it still goes on, I might add, and they're not, don't all come out of it terribly healthily, but then nor do a lot of American football players, as we now discover, that they're getting damaged heads and things like that. So I know 20 damaged heads or one dead person is a bit of a top up, isn't it? to choose which is the best or the worst of the two. But it is an amazing event. And as a cameraman, as a film crew, as we were there, where you were standing in the middle of the pitch, you know, hoping they're going to go past you, you are potentially a victim too. They didn't try and kill us. They could have easily done it if they'd want to, or hit us very hard with these things. But they certainly frightened us by flinging spears that plunged into the ground, albeit with blunted tips right next to us between our legs and everything. But it was a feeling of great festivity, even though it was dangerous. And the interesting thing about it is, of course, it's very difficult to tell exact. You've got to begin this at exactly the right time. And the priests there are astronomers insofar as they know just which phases of the moon are likely to produce what. And what they're looking for is the emergence of these red sea worms, all of which crowd the beach at a certain point, not on the full moon, it's a few days before, a few days after. And they have to know when, because everybody, thousands of people are all lined up waiting for the okay from the priests. And lo and behold, we couldn't believe this. There they were, up they come, all these red worms. And then the place is chaos.
Wow, fabulous. And now you've recently been doing some travels around Indonesia.
I do a lot still. I still lecture on boats. And they quietened down a bit during COVID, but not altogether. There were liverboards that still traveled around. And I just lectured on this thing called the National Geographic Orion from Bali to the Solomon Islands, which took us all the way back to New Guinea, to close to where we had lived many years ago, filming the Azmat, where Michael Rockefeller disappeared. Different story.
Oh.
Of the infamous Rockefeller family.
Well, absolutely. This was Nelson's son.
Okay.
At the time, Nelson was governor of New York. He was later vice president. And his son, Michael Rockefeller, didn't really want anything to do with the family business. He was much more interested in tribal art. And the most valuable and the most interesting tribal art in the world at the time, and it's still high on the list, is that from the Asmat tribe of New Guinea, who have the distinction of being not only cannibals, but headhunters. You're one or the other, but it's quite rare in anthropology that you're both at the same time. But to be also superb artists is even more interesting. They weren't nothing at all, except amazing stuff on their faces and through their earlobes. But we lived with them for a month, dressing as they dressed, as in Zero. And we brought out this film, which explained why Michael Rockefeller had disappeared there, which was a big mystery in 1962. Most people argued all over the world that he had been drowned, that he had drowned, but no, he'd washed up there. And as I say, they only kill and eat people of a neighboring tribe or village. You've already killed and eaten one of you. But the Dutch relinquished New Guinea very late, and they got all nervous trying to put down a headhunting raid, and they went in there and they shot a bunch of their chieftains. That's the first time the white man came into the cycle of revenge. And so they waited for all these years, about 4 years actually, until young Rockefeller was there collecting their art, admiring their culture.
Oh, wow. And he was the last most recent person from the white person tribe.
That's right.
To come to visit.
That's right.
Well, the reason I wanted to pick up on that is because obviously, you know, on this show, we talk a lot about counterculture ideas, counterculture philosophy. We're kind of trying to position our philosophy in this larger conversation about where is the world going and how do these counterculture ideas kind of fit into that. And the reason the Rockefeller story is interesting to me is because obviously the Rockefeller family represents that capitalistic, you know, whatever it is that you want to call it.
He was the king of oil and steel.
Yeah, yeah. And to think that he was in New Guinea, was in Papua New Guinea, is that where that was?
Yes, West Papua.
And was he there trying to make money off it, or he was just interested in the art?
No, he was there because he was really interested in the art. Mm-hmm. He wasn't at all interested in what his father and family were interested in. And what's interesting is, as you point out, his dad was like the scion of oil and of steel, particularly. Mm-hmm. And the Asmat people are pre-Stone Age. Mm-hmm. They have no stones. It's an alluvial swamp. Mm. The stones are incredibly valuable, sacred substances that they have to risk their lives to get 200 miles away for special ceremonies for them. So they are not only pre-Stone Age, they're pre-Steel Age. And yet this son, Rockefeller, of the Steel King of the West, finished up as the sacrifice to the men of wood, as they call themselves.
Wow.
And of course it is steel that cuts down the forests of the world, or has done since then. To say nothing of what else steel has helped do. Without steel, we could not drill for oil either.
Right. You're reminding me of Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yeah.
And do you remember the very beginning of that book? This always stuck with me. He was there. So for people that don't know, Guns, Germs, and Steel was written by, I think, a UCLA professor. He was an anthropologist, and he was in Papua New Guinea studying whatever he was studying. But when he starts the book by telling this little story about how when he's in Papua New Guinea, he has one of the locals helping him unload the plane. And they've got all this shit, you know, all the stuff for living and science and whatever. And the person asked him a very simple question. He's like, why do you have so much stuff? And that was kind of the beginning of this exploration that became Guns, Germs, and Steel. But getting to your point there, that like none of this is possible. You talk about industrialized society and capitalist society. None of it is possible without those very key technological developments and key people like the Rockefellers to push that forward.
That's right.
And those people aren't really going anywhere. I mean, they've kind of changed form, and now you have the new barons of technology. So what are your thoughts on, what do you do with people like that? Like, how do you manage?
I don't think I can tell you.
agreed. But you see what I'm getting at, though.
I think it's a very like fine line in how to meld these things. Like, we've been recently listening to a lot of Rupert Sheldrake stuff. And we know he, as a scientist, has really struggled.
Wonderful man.
Wonderful, yeah.
And his son is even more so.
Okay. But it's this line between science and nature or the
mysticism and science.
Mm-hmm. I kind of want to know where you think we are now, maybe touching a little bit on the age of Aquarius and what you maybe foresee. Because there is this kind of, we also talk a lot about this Ubudian movement and this kind of movement now from the West, you know, learning yoga and spirituality and whatever version of Tantra seems to be out there now. And kind of where you see the shift going. And if you think we have hope, and maybe comparing a little bit to the hope that was around in the 60s and yeah, what your thoughts are.
I do. And I think, you know, it's really hard to tell people to save the planet and stop burning it up if you don't feel what the planet is.
Mm-hmm.
And because most of us are urban, we haven't had a chance to feel what it is. So, I mean, I consider my task, not that I've decided it with my left brain, as I've discovered that my task is more to ignite this sense of awe and that we know so incredibly little and so much is there to be known and so much mm-hmm. is going on. And this is one of the things I love about Sheldrake, who was a great hero of the 60s and 70s. I know him well because we were at conferences together in the early days and everything. And I'm absolutely addicted to his son's work because he is the author and a great expert in mycelium, as you probably mm-hmm. know, which is how the discovery, it's a whole new kingdom, rather as plants and animals are their own kingdoms and bacteria their own kingdoms. Fungus is a kingdom of its own, and it was only established as such in the 1970s.
Oh, really?
Recently. And it turns out that, of course, it is responsible for everything. But both of these people, you know, Rupert Sheldrake has the distinction of being one of the only three people who gave a major TED lecture by invitation and then was thrown out the door. His lecture was denied.
No way.
So if you look up banned TED lectures, you'll see three really good lectures.
Ones. Oh, I love that.
One of them, his lecture was particularly about scientific materialism, how science nowadays is like a religion. And if you dare contradict it by exploring something
and
new, suddenly observing, say, that steam coming out of a kettle might actually drive a steam engine, you're being a heretic. And that's why so many of the most interesting subjects or areas of research in consciousness are suppressed and get no funding. For instance, he wrote a book about the sense of being stared at.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently a great percentage of us have this, even if we're being stared at from behind our backs. But he says you can't get any funding because science says there's no known medium by which that could be possible. Well, how unscientific is that?
Yeah.
And of course, his other wonderful book, I think, is Dogs That Know When Their Parents Are Coming Home.
Yeah.
You know, that's dynamite. They don't all know. Some of them are really stupid, but some of them are really sensible and together and tuned in. And morphogenetic resonance fields is another a subject that he developed, I think, in the 80s, which wasn't maybe the late 70s, but I think it was the 80s, quite late. And now there is more and more evidence to support this idea. I mean, is it worth saying what this is? Morphogenetic resonance fields.
Yes, that kind of, we can also explain communication between animals and...
Go for it.
Between that every species has mm-hmm. its own genetic memory of what it has gone through, and it is still there. It is carried by this etheric habit form. For instance, if you teach rats how to perform a really difficult function like going through a really hard type of maze in New York, and suddenly the rats are getting it, all the other rats that were trying to get it in Tokyo and Ottawa can suddenly do it more easily, as if the morphogenetic field of ratness has jumped up a notch and everybody has access to it. And in a way, this goes on. There are many other examples of it. For instance, if you take a fairy, or shall we say a nursery rhyme in Turkish, and you force people in England or the States to learn a nonsense poem to them in a foreign language, if you give them one that has actually been recited to children, albeit in another language, for hundreds and hundreds of years, it's much easier for them to learn than is a nonsense one that also mm-hmm. rhymes, because it has left its imprint in the morphogenetic resonance field that has built up by the repetition of this. And he also goes on to ask you, this is the power of religion as well. This is why religion is very conservative. It seeks to use the same mantras over and over again, because it is more likely to throw you into the resonance frequency that resonates all the way down through time, and that everybody who was doing that in the past, you're all on the same wavelength again. It is a fascinating field of study. It addresses our health problems in certain ways as well, how we can break these morphogenetic resonance patterns with conscious awareness.
That is, yeah, it's fascinating.
And we see that so much with alternative medicine, and how so much of there's like books like You Are the Placebo and things that kind of explain that your health is so much driven by your mind.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is that awareness and that recognition that the morphic resonance is a thing. Is also encouraging for what we can just call like umbrella term, counterculture, alternative, whatever it is that you want to call it, this resistance to industrialized society, because it guides us. It says, okay, well, you just keep at it, you know, and after generation after generation, that resonance will amplify.
Yes.
And the idea, I guess, is that that resonance will at some point become the dominant one. So rather than this, like you said, left brain, you know, religious orthodoxy, this domination.
Male dominance.
Yeah. That's been the resonance through many, many, many generations, many thousands of years. But we're slowly starting to shift that.
Yes.
And the frequency is shifting.
Absolutely.
And it's encouraging. But also it's scary, because when you look at it in that sense, you realize like when you go into a big city and you enter that field, you realize like how overbearing it is. And I know for myself, like when I've lived in environments like that, regardless of how I feel, it's easy to be overtaken by that resonance.
Yes.
And that frequency starts like vibrating in every cell in your body, and you just be overtaken by it.
And it argues for meditating personally, because that keeps you open to being in the right frequency patterns, or different ones from the ones of your environment if they're negative and destructive. You know, you can go away and be yourself despite this ubiquity of resonance.
Is that part of why you came to Indonesia?
I could say that, but that sounds like it's like a left brain decision. You know, being brought up in Mexico, going from England to Mexico in the 50s was just so fantastic. The roof was off your head. You know, we're suddenly in ancient civilizations and tropical animals and a sense of heat and adventure and differentness. So when my brother and I got to Indonesia, it was like Mexico multiplied by 100.
Yeah, yeah.
So this was an area of mystery, a sea of wonders you could swim in and catch these little gems of meaning, which was much harder to do in my own culture. One more quite famous example, by the way, of morphogenetic resonance fields, which is often quoted, is the one of these monkeys, time of monkey in Japan, that likes to eat sweet potatoes and can catch them itself on near the beach, near the sea, but they don't particularly like them with sand in them. And one group in one of the islands, the Japanese islands, stumbled on washing their potatoes first in the sea before eating them. We thought it was fairly normal, but no. Within a few months of one group learning this, all the other monkeys scattered around the place, unless they had the internet linking them together, was morphogenetic resonance, because for their species it had become easier.
You see it even with things like sports and like the things that the way people surf now were not even feasible, you know, especially like little girls and things would no way be doing that. Even just like 30 years ago.
That's right.
So,
yeah, it's a beautiful thing realizing. I think that what I'm taking away from this conversation, it's been a really, really great conversation, Pac Lawrence, if I may call you that.
Please.
That's what Rishi told me to call you, Pac Lawrence. And I liked it. I think it has a ring to it. Well, it's just this idea that we do have reasons to be hopeful.
God, yes.
And I liked how Ram Dass put it, just to tie it to some of the themes of the show. We did an episode and we talked about Ram Dass, and he was having this conversation with Terence McKenna, who you were also friends with, if I know.
Only by phone.
By phone.
Ram Dass, I knew well. He was here in Bali, of course.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he came and stayed with me up in
Really?
Yes.
Okay, well, we kind of need to, I think we need to do a second episode just where, if you have time, just so we can talk about.
I want to hear the Leary stories.
I want to hear the Leary stories too. This is absolutely.
Episode two, yes.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll put those in the back burner. But what Ram Dass said to Terence McKenna, they were having a debate basically about, well, it was a friendly kind of discussion that they had a little disagreement because Terence McKenna, or was it Ram Dass that said, one of them said that basically all that hope and all that inspiration and all this idealism that came out of the 60s diminished. And there was a serious pushback in the 70s.
Well, they said they were naive, I think, is the way they put it in how things were going.
Well, yeah. And I think it was McKenna that said, you know, well, I can't remember which one, but basically that one was saying, well, it kind of disappeared. Or there was so much resistance to it, mainstream pushback to the counterculture, that it was essentially squashed. And I think it was Ram Dass that said, no, that getting back to the morphic resonance, he said that reverberation was made and you felt it. And then he used the example of how he was in the 60s, he was talking to all these, you know, wild-eyed, you know, flower children that were tripped on LSD and, you know, they were in it, of course. Mm. But then 30 years later, talking to like a suburban housewife in middle America, and he's like, oh, they get it. They were on the same thing. So in his mind, it was like that reverberation was continuing through the generations. Mm. And that's kind of what I'm getting from this conversation, seeing you here now, this many years later, Rushi and I and people in our generation that have kind of like taken the torch and said, all right.
Absolutely. And it is coming back so strongly. I mean, what the 60s had to say and what we discovered is very much being revisited now and in a higher octave in a way, because if you look at the cutting edge of the new sciences of the biological world, it is wonderfully mysterious and miraculous. I mean, we give that example of the mycelium, of how all trees are connected through their root systems, through these strands of fungus. These strands of mycelium, they carry bacteria, they carry
nutrients
and electrical energy and information, chemical information that informs trees at the very periphery of these stands, for instance, that there is a type, say, a tiny spider that eats their leaves very dangerously, and it is time to pump out a toxin that attracts, or a honey, if you like, that attracts a predator on these little creatures. So it is like a single brain, with all these synapses connected together. A whole stand of trees is like that. So it opens up a world we haven't even been able to visualize until now of interconnectedness, of the extreme sophistication of life that rational science doesn't yet have an explanation for, but which is nevertheless there.
What's funny is that this is knowledge that we have actually known for thousands of years, you know, and this interconnectedness and things like the Chinese philosophy of just like the Tao and everything having its balance and yin and yang and dark and light. These are all, you know, this is all knowledge that we've had for generations.
And the tribal people, for instance, of Borneo have exactly that understanding, but it is couched in kind of more religious, mystically terms that Westerners turned their heads away from, but now they can look back again.
Yeah, I think that's really a beautiful way to kind of bring it back full circle.
Yeah, yeah, the intelligence of nature. And if people want to hear more from you, Pac Lawrence, you have an upcoming, well, you've got Ring of Fire is available. So that's the documentary series that you did with your brother. It came out in the 80s, is that right?
That's right.
And it's a beautiful documentary series about exploration, about science.
We won a couple of Emmys for it, too.
Yeah, Emmy Award winning.
It was quite serious at the time.
Definitely. No, that's awesome. And then Rhythms of Vision is a book that you wrote.
Show up on the camera.
Yeah, put Rhythms of Vision. Rishi's got her copy. Rishi's a big fan.
Well, dog-eared, I'm happy to see.
Yes.
And then there's more recently a film called, for instance, I was in Bali Island of the Dogs. Instead of Island of the Gods, it's Bali Island of the Dogs. And if you like, it's the dogs here that are very special. They're probably the worst treated dogs in the world. You know, they're sacrificed, they're eaten. And yet they're the most valuable dogs because they're the richest source of genetic diversity in all of dogdom and all sorts of other things. So it is about humans and the environment and how we see them in different ways. And also I did a series for Sky TV UK called Myths, Magic and Monsters. I don't have control of it anymore, but it's out there and it is about that sort of stuff.
Great.
The wonders of nature and the human mind.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we will link to that. Rishi, anything else you want to ask Pac Lawrence? Or?
I think we're going to have to maybe save it for another episode.
I think so too. Pac Lawrence, you want to leave folks with anything else?
Well, and it's just been a pleasure talking to you. And the main thing is that we have every reason to be incredibly optimistic if we're not too selfish about things. Because if we remember that the Earth has survived many extinctions, if our heart is in the right place, it shouldn't matter too much that the human tribe disappears, since we ourselves are transitionary.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just hope we don't mess it up too much before we go.
Yes, indeed. I like that. Good place to leave it. Thank you so much. That's Lawrence Blair, anthropologist, filmmaker, explorer, mystic. Is that an appropriate way to say it?
Totally. You fortunately left all the other adjectives out.
Thank you so much, Pac Lawrence. And we will have, if we can, we'll have you back and do this again.
For sure.
And thank you for listening to What's What. We'll see you soon.